Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 21st of July. I hope you had a lovely weekend. I hope you had you made the best of the situations that were presented to us. And whether the weather was good where you were or not so good or a mix of all, I hope you enjoyed yourself in one way, shape, or form. It is a pleasure to have you back. First of all, first and foremost, let me, on behalf of every member of this radio station and its cast and crew, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Friday was one of the most special days I've ever had here at WAMC as we lost federal funding. That was the bad part. And then the good part was we opened up and we broadcast from 9 o'clock until noon, and then from 2 until 5, and we made almost half the money that we will lose as a result of the clawback from the Congress. And it was an amazing day. It was very, I will say that the notes from listeners were poignant and beautiful, and some of them just would tear your heart out. And it was as buoyant a day as you could as it could be for given what it was and why we were there. But thanks to everybody in the studio, Sarah Gilbert, Ian Pickus, and Sarah LaDuke, myself, we had a great time. And everybody, Lucas Willard was in with us. We had an amazing roster of guests, thanks to everybody who joined us from NPR and the folks from the government sector, and Natalie Merchant, and the list just goes on and on. It was a very special day, and we thank you very much. As we promised, we're not going to bug you again. We just wanted to open up the opportunity to have the dialogue and to give you an opportunity as well to know what was going on and what we needed. So thank you all so much. We appreciate it from the bottom of our hearts. All right. Coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, I'm very excited about this. E. Jean Carroll is joining us this morning. She'll be live by telephone, and we'll be talking to her about her book. It is a rather rarity to get her to do a live interview, a live radio interview, and just an interview. And she's agreed to do it with us. Her new book, which is a New York Times bestseller, it's called Not My Type, One Woman Versus a President. She has won in court against Donald Trump, not once, but twice. And she has a hell of a story to tell. I will also say, I will say this to her, I will say this to you, the home listeners. This is one of the most entertaining books I have read in a very, very long time. You add to the fact that at its core is about sexual abuse, and it is a miracle that it is as entertaining and incredible and open as it is. She is a force of nature, and I think you will enjoy her, and we look forward to our conversation coming up at 11 o'clock. Very, very good stuff. Now, let me, the book is good stuff. I could screw up the interview. I'm not saying that. But we'll get to that. Nah. We'll get to that at 11 o'clock. Now, let me introduce everybody who is here in this room to talk about what is happening in the world. And we welcome the following individuals in alphabetical order. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham is here. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you so much. We also welcome Senior Fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I'm happy to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I am good.
All right. We'll take it at that.
Yeah.
Good morning, all. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I will admit I had some trouble putting stories together for today because they just seemed very disparate and odd. And so we're panel, I will leave it up to you that if you want to move on, just let me know and we'll do that. They're all good stories. They're all important stories. But sort of putting them into a, I don't know, an order and a telling a story was difficult last night. But here we go. I would like to talk about what to know about the deadly violence near Gaza aid sites, and which seemed to be just, well, it was an awful thing, and we want to talk about it. At least 32 people were reported killed on Saturday, and more than 60 a day later, adding to the mounting death toll of Gazans. And this happens as people are losing their lives as they try to get food. Palestinians trying to secure food were shot and killed in the Gaza Strip in two separate episodes over the weekend when Israeli forces opened fire on crowds. On Saturday, the soldiers shot Palestinians near a food distribution site in Rafah in southern Gaza. A day later, they fired at crowds who had gathered near a border crossing used by aid trucks to enter the enclave. Palestinian health officials said more than 60 people were killed in the episode on Sunday. On Saturday, near an aid distribution site run by American contractors and backed by Israel and the United States, at least 32 people were killed, according to local health officials. The violence added to the mounting death toll for hungry Palestinians killed while seeking food since late May, when Israel lifted a blockade in place for roughly 80 days on humanitarian assistance entering Gaza. I will hold there in reading from that New York Times report about the violence near these Gazan aid sites. Jim Ketter, we'll let you begin.
Okay. Well, I thought it might be useful to just take a step back and think about one aspect of this story, which is the delivery of humanitarian aid and how it's happening in Gaza, and how and why we think it's leading to these particular incidents, these deadly incidents. But I think there's an overall trend here that's worth paying attention to. So this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has been established by the Israeli government, funded by the United States government. But what we see is something that has been a longer-term trend. And by I say longer-term, certainly since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, if not sooner, earlier than that. And that is the privatization and, in some cases, the militarization of humanitarian aid. And so as USAID has been dismantled and gone away, there were people in the aid community, and I worked on USAID projects for many, many years, so I know that world pretty well, people who were saying, well, what is the vision for what comes next? Is this just from the Trump administration? Is it just chaos and destruction and there's nothing coming next? And I think what we see taking shape, and this might be a good test case in Gaza, a test case for us to analyze, not good in that it's good to see, but it's useful to analyze it, is this privatization and this relationship between these humanitarian aid institutions that are going into conflict zones, are protected by private military contractors. This is something we saw a lot of in the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And relationships with big money consulting groups, in this case the Boston Consulting Group, who has been involved not only in supporting this foundation, but a lot of the other mainline humanitarian organizations over the last few years. And there's a lot of money at play. There and the stakes are particularly high. For instance, the Boston Consulting Group has been outed for not only supporting this foundation and its operations and the delivery of humanitarian aid, but also apparently drawing up plans for the removal of Palestinians from Gaza. And now this is something that I have heard rumors of, heard talking about from October 8th. Joe, I was on the air here, the program after the attacks on October 7th.
Correct.
And I was already hearing from people in the Middle East that one of the things that was being talked about in the immediate aftermath was that Gaza would be evacuated. And it sounded so large and preposterous and a massive violation of international law. It just didn't seem possible. But I have continued to hear that and continue to hear that there's a variety of countries in the region that are not only knowledgeable about this, but are quietly supporting that idea. And then when Donald Trump became president, he, as he often does, says the quiet part out loud and talked about that. And so this confluence of these kind of, you know, these sorts of military goals with the delivery of humanitarian aid and the sidelining, last thing I will say is the sidelining of things like the UN. There's a very accomplished British diplomat, Tom Fletcher, who runs the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And he's been on the ground. He's been doing some very important kind of reporting from the ground on what's going on. And the UN has been, they've largely been sidelined through other UN agencies that were seen as too radioactive by the U.S. And Israel. But his office has also just a very small part to play. So I think this is the shape of things to come. And what is lost in all the conversation is, well, what's the political horizon for right. Israel and the Palestinians? What do the Israelis have to say about where this is all going, whether it's one state, two states, what have you? Totally lost, I think, in all of this conversation.
Obviously, it adds to the chaos, but then you look at these immediate things that are happening and wonder, okay, well, how do you just stop that?
Right, right. And you know, stopping this kind of killing, being able to deliver food aid. I mean, people have been shot, but there are also people starving to death. And what I think is just one step away from this in our analysis, too, is what is also going to be good not only for Palestinians, not Hamas, but Palestinians, but what's going to be good for Israelis and the long-term safety and security of Israel. I don't see it adding up in a way that answers those questions well.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, I have to say what Israel is doing is making it incredibly unsafe for Jews around the world because their actions just foment what some people will call anti-Zionism, which I get, but then it automatically almost becomes anti-Semitism and the attacks have been happening, and you know, everybody knows we're at the top of the list these days. And you know, it's so what Israel is doing is so antithetical to the basic teachings of Judaism, of Tikkun Olam, which is healing the world. This is not healing the world. This is ripping the world apart so that one man can stay in power and stay out of jail. Right? And it's so eerily familiar because the same thing is happening in the United States. And then we have Japan, right? That when the parliamentary elections or whatever their elections are, went to the populace, to the right wing. I mean, we are seeing strong Western type democracies keep getting whittled away by the forces of authoritarianism and fascism. And, you know, it's just not who we are to shoot at innocent people who just want to feed their kids is a war crime. I'm sorry. You know, it's just not who we are as a people. And I'm sure I'll hear from some other people in today, but I really don't care. It's disgusting. And I really, you know, Ezra Klein had a great article in The Times over the weekend. But really, you know, when Israel does this, they are making the world unsafe for Jews everywhere.
Robert.
I think that Jim and Libby have some interesting points here, and I agree completely that this is the obvious manifestation of breakdown of an international system. I mean, the UN was involved in the food distribution on Thursday, but it didn't have the same kind of support that it would normally have from other NGOs and international organizations. There's a lot of finger-pointing going on who's responsible. The UN points to Israel, Israel points to the UN, but to me it all shows that You know, there's a fundamental breakdown in the way that, as Jim said, the way the aid is distributed. I think a lot of this actually goes back to Rwanda, when the UN got a bad rap for having the bad guys inside the fence and feeding the bad guys. And so there was a distrust that was sown there of the UN's capability to deliver this kind of aid. But actually, the UN generally does a pretty good job. What's missing in all of that is a Palestinian voice from a logistics standpoint. Usually in aid distribution, as Jim well knows, in aid distribution situations, the people receiving aid have a voice in the process. They have to. There's no part of that here. And that's what makes part of this not only tragic, but almost unsolvable.
Yeah, and Hamas, you know, this is not a good group of guys. And they were weaponizing the delivery of aid before. And we saw that, you know, if you're old enough, like I am, cast your mind back to Somalia in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. This is the reason that George H.W. Bush sent in American forces to stop the people who were ID'd, as I recall, who was doing the same thing. So this is a constant problem. But, you know, we have dealt with it in the past, and there's ways to deal with it. And this does not strike me as a positive way to deal with that issue.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on this issue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. You can keep them short and to the point. We like that. And that way we can get to as many as possible. And again, we welcome you to write to us, panel@wamc.org.
And then I'll climb to the highest steeple and tell the world he's mine till he holds me away.
Probably most of you are aware of this, but the reason we're playing Connie Francis this morning is that she passed away last week on Friday, right? The 16th. And we wanted to remember her this morning. And may she rest in peace. And we'll listen to some Connie Francis hits
Friday
this
was
morning.
The 18th, just so you
Friday
know.
Was the 18th, so that would be Wednesday.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you, Libby.
You're welcome. Just because I'm looking at my calendar.
No, that's good. I appreciate it. You can see the complete playlist and see the tracks that we played on line at wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. And we thank you very much for being here. And panel@wamc.org, if you would like to get in and join us and talk to us about the issue at hand, which in this case is Gaza. Let's go to some letters, and we'll continue with conversation between our panelists as well. Gail writes to us and says, our so-called government and the Israeli government are succeeding in destroying what was Gaza and the West Bank and the Palestinian people. It is almost too late to stop this. At least we can bring daily attention to the crimes, the tragedy, the suffering of children and parents in this incredible crime of the oligarchic era. There are many other examples from the past. Can we not stop this one now? In Pope Francis's words, we face the globalization of indifference. And that is from Gail. We go to another letter, this one from Tristan. Good morning, panel. Have the Arab states in the Middle East abandoned the Palestinians? What are they doing to pressure Israel or support Palestinians in Gaza? They seem to value improved relationships with Trump more than the welfare of the Palestinians. Israel is doing whatever they want in Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon, yet the Arab neighbors seem to be okay with it all. Does anyone know why?
They've always turned their backs on the Palestinians from 1948 on. They when Israel was established and some folks were forced from their homes. I mean, it was mass. There was a lot of people. And the Arab states said, nope, you're not coming here. So it's a people without a homeland, but it's also a people without support from people you'd expect to support them.
I heard an old hand say once that the Palestinians were the Kurds of the region.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
That no one will take ownership. It's too thorny.
And you will, you know, often hear public statements from the Arab governments in the region that are supportive, but then the reality of the actions, as both Bob and Libby are saying, is not on a regular basis. Now, there are reasons that these states will take, that they'll state and they'll say, well, you know, if we do X, Y, or Z, this undermines the negotiating position for them. For instance, for the Palestinians who have been for generations in Lebanon, the reason that they have not become Lebanese citizens, according to the Lebanese, is that, well, they ought to be able to return. And if we do this, that undermines that dynamic. And so there, you know, you will see multiple layers of these kinds of explanations. But the reality is that when it comes down to specific agreements and treaties, that the Palestinians have been consistently cut out. I mean, from Camp David Accords between Egypt and Israel and Abraham Accords and on and on. So that does not appear to be the answer to this conundrum.
If I can add on to what Jim's saying here, Joe, it's also in the larger structure, the larger international system. I mean, the ICJ is set up for states, International Court of Justice. And, you know, Israel's not a member of the ICC, so there's just no other international body that can step in into a system that's already established that's going to do much here.
Yeah. I mean, and on Gaza specifically, you know, the Egyptian government, which has, quote unquote, helped to manage Gaza, I mean, before October 7th with the Israelis, the current Egyptian government worked hand in glove with the Israeli government. And the Egyptian government of Sisi, very, very virulently anti-Hamas, because Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. Sisi ousted a Muslim Brotherhood president and subsequently declared that organization to be a terrorist organization, and anybody who is in it is a criminal. And so, you know, you have really seen behind the scenes more coordination between Egypt and Israel than you have seen the Egyptians standing up for Palestinians.
And we can't forget that in 1948, the proposal was a two-state solution, and the Arab countries said no.
All right. Let us go to another letter from our listeners. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Louise writes to us and says, what's happening in Gaza can only be called genocide. Instead of gas chambers, they're using food aid. Between starvation and shooting people at food banks, they're trying to wipe out the Palestinian population. And that, again, from Louise. And we had, I tagged one more letter here that I wanted to read. Palestinians are not, as Libby said, a people without a homeland. Palestine is their homeland.
I also want to just mention one other thing, too.
For radio listeners, Libby is nodding.
Yes. It's a radio nod. It's a radio nod.
And you can go back in history, and Israel is the Jewish homeland. I mean, we can debate that point ad nauseum forever.
But how do we solve the immediate
problem? Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is, how do we stop what's going on?
And also, it's interesting and important to see, too, that there are more Israelis who are speaking up and saying, what is the policy here? Where are we going? What is the direction of this? And how is this going to be, number one, you know, beneficial for the safety and security of Israel and Israelis overall and Jews around the world, as Libby was saying, and you know, really have a serious take at, if not solving the problem, mitigating the problem in a way that just doesn't seem to be on the table for the people who are actually running the Israeli government. But just as with the, you know, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, And all that transpired after that, eventually you started to see a real backlash within Israel to say, what in the world is going on? Why are we sending our young people into this place that is quicksand and has, you know, has no policy end that is beneficial to us? And you're starting to see more of that in Israel
yes.
now, too.
And you can't forget, pre-October 7th, right, it was October 7th.
Yeah, October 7th.
Right? Pre-October 7th, Netanyahu, they took their eye away from defense, thinking, oh, we have this settled and we have this taken care of, and was trying to dismantle the Supreme Court structure and the judicial structure in Israel, right, to make the Supreme Court much less strong, to dismantle it. In its legal capacity, and people were in the streets saying no.
Right. Many
no,
people.
No,
yeah.
no, no. This is a democracy. We're the only democracy in the Middle East. We want this democracy to be maintained. We want a strong judiciary, you know, all of that. And so that was where he was focused, and then October 6th happened. October 7th, I can't, you know.
October 7th.
It happened. And the focus immediately went back to what is politically good for Netanyahu. However, his coalition government is fraying at the edges. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks, because the ultra-right in the Knesset are leaving his coalition because he's not right-wing enough. it's just, you can't make this up. And I didn't say the word I wanted to, but you just can't make this up.
No, that's all right. But thank you for not
You're
saying.
You're welcome.
Just one point to ponder, just not to ponder, but just to add to the equation before we go to a break and then move on to other subjects. So you have 4 aid sites where these Palestinians are coming each morning hoping to obtain food. 700 people have been killed while trying to get aid from those sites, according to data last week, so this would have been before what happened over the weekend, by the United Nations, and eyewitnesses and Gaza health officials have repeatedly accused Israeli forces of shooting into those crowds. So just once again, putting a cap on that as an understanding of what is happening. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will return with our group, Jim Ketter, Robert Brigham, and Libby Post, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Monday morning, the 21st of July. It is 47 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We're going to move on to other subjects with our panel and take one of the issues that just we're going to touch on for a moment, and then we'll get in depth into some other stories after the break at the top of the hour. Realizing we were off Friday, we weren't off, but we were begging for money. because the federal government took all our money away, our federal money. So we are we didn't talk about this as this story just continues to move on and become curiouser and curiouser. And that is Republicans and Democrats now calling for more information when it comes to the Trump-Epstein relationship and that case. Members of Congress from both parties said they wanted to see more files released, while President Trump has encouraged his base to move on. Days after the Justice Department asked a federal judge to unseal grand jury testimony related to the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein, Republicans and Democrats suggested on Sunday that the move was insufficient and called for the release of more information.
I think it's a good start, Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee said in an interview on CNN, Republican. But he still wanted to see as many files as possible released. He added later, President Trump has been contending with fierce criticism from some of his very own supporters over his administration's handling of materials related to the sex trafficking investigations of Mr. Epstein and his connections to rich and powerful figures on the left and right. Mr. Epstein died by suicide in 2019 while in federal prison awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. Also, what happened on Friday, we talked about it a tiny bit while we were having our larger conversation about federal cuts. And that was the story of the president suing the Wall Street Journal that reportedly saw a birthday card that the president sent Jeffrey Epstein, in which was there was a crude picture included, and with a reference to secrets in this. The president has flatly denied this and then went as far as to sue Rupert Murdoch, interestingly enough. Then finally, never mind.
you just can't make it up.
I mean, and so it, when I say crude, for example, there's this it's of a woman, and then Donald Trump's flamboyant signature was the pubic hair of the woman, according to the reporting in the Wall Street Journal. I bring that up for no other reason other than the president also said, I don't do pictures, and then I don't do drawings, and then in nanosecond, they started talking about all these auctions that had taken place over the years in which President Trump's various drawings were up for auction for various charities. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, back at the FBI, an accuser story suggests how Trump might appear in the Epstein files. A former Jeffrey Epstein employee said that she told the FBI in 1996 and 2006 about what she considered a troubling encounter with Trump, which now seems to suggest that could be the item that is included within this, within the files, and maybe the reason for this back and forth. Her account is among the clearest indications yet of how Mr. Trump might have come to be named in the unreleased investigative files in the Epstein case, a matter that has generated another public uproar in the last several weeks.
Who are you going to believe? You know, you're going to believe your eyes with all these pictures? You're going to believe Maria Farmer, who has twice told the FBI and state authorities that she met with Trump and quotes Epstein, you know, saying she's not here for you. To me, Joe, this seems that Trump's got a problem here that it can't easily solve. He whipped this issue into a campaign issue twice, assuming that the paper trail would lead to this, you know, Pizzagate and beyond, right? That it would lead to these elite Democrats, include Bill Clinton and others. And it's a web that he constructed himself. And I don't see an easy way for him to get out of this, because how many Maria Farmers are there? She's the only one we know about right now that's come forward saying I twice talked to authorities. But there must be others out there. And that's the nature of an investigation. It starts really wide. So this grand jury stuff is just, it's the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's just impossible to think that he's not going to get caught up in this somehow.
Here's what I don't understand, though. And I keep asking this question, not to individual panelists, but just out loud, which is why? If you think that there is a scent, a hint a scintilla of information that would bring the president of the United States into that, as Pam Bondi would hold up a binder and say, we're going to release this. It's on my desk. I'm going to review it, and we're going to put it out into the world. And that's what I don't understand.
Yeah, he may not be on that client list that may or may not sit on Bondi's desk, but clearly, just from the photos and the videos alone, before Trump cut off the relationship, they had a long-term relationship, and he has to, at some point, account for that.
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I think they did what they did, and to answer your question, is because they think they're omnipotent, and Trump thinks his followers are stupid. We know that. He has said, I love the uneducated, and that's the base of his base, and that they'll follow him wherever, and now they're not. Because I find it interesting that this is what could break Donald Trump. It's this. There are, it's not part of the investigation, but I've been seeing, the legal agreements that have come out between Trump and young women, right? The amounts of money that he paid them off, because of sexual assault. You know, the man is a predator. He's a predator against our democracy, and he's a predator against women, and he's a predator against having a moral compass, because we don't have one anymore. And so, I really think that in his addled mind, he thinks, if I say it's not true, then everyone's going to believe it's not true. And
well, he has
it.
A pretty good track record with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know, he
it's
does.
Been successful.
But this is for whatever reason, the right is, his followers want to know, because it's the deep state stuff and all the rest of that conspiracy theory they had about the government and blah, 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 But I also think part of the reason why some Republicans are saying we need to release this is because they know ultimately his grip on the party is going to be its demise.
Yeah.
And they want that gone.
Yeah.
And he's a lame duck.
Yes.
And I think that now we see behind the scenes and stirring up some of this anti-Trump MAGA reaction are people who are positioning themselves to take hold of that base. Because if you're on that side of the political aisle, that's a very valuable, powerful base to have. This is a base that has been holding together. They turn out. And so whether it's Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, or others, they have been saying a variety of things, even aside from the Epstein thing, that appear to be distancing themselves from Trump. For instance, after Mamdani won the primary, Trump said, we'll never have a communist in power, something like that. Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene were in a conversation, an on-air conversation with each other, and they were saying positive things about Mamdani. Now, why and what that really means and whatever, but it's not on the Trump script. And so you're seeing some interesting dynamics here.
I'm sorry, let me go ahead.
No, I just want to say, but for them to think that they'll get the base is delusional, because it's a cult of personality.
Well, that's what you said this may be the thing that brings them down. I mean, if I had all the money in the world, I would bet that that's not the case. Okay.
But there might be a reason this has more staying power than other things that should have brought Trump down.
Oh, my God, we have to talk about this more in the months to have. I don't mean yeah. today. I just mean yeah. in the months to come, but go ahead.
Okay, so if we look at the other issues, the her emails, all the other things that he has used
right.
to kind of whip the base into action, this is the one that cuts across all issues. Mm-hmm. It cuts across the Hollywood elite. It cuts across the deep state. It cuts across money, the manufacturing industry. It is the one issue that's out there that he built almost from scratch that hits all of the key talking points that the MAGA base wants to hear. And there, I can't think of any other issues that really combine it all the way that this does.
The other thing is that there was an article, I believe, in the Washington Post about how it really has derailed all the other messages that they were trying. Yeah. Not that this administration is always real good about
keeping messages on track. But as far as the other things that were in the works to be talked about, that those are no longer first and foremost because they're dealing with this particular issue, and also the back and forth and the blaming it on the Democrats and then screaming at the Republicans is an odd look too, right? I mean, the mental gymnastics of how you get to blaming the Democrats on this is astounding to me. But
right. He's got a 6.0 on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll talk more. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. First, we have a few messages, and then, oh, my God, the sun is finally back in the sky. Ray Graff is back from vacation. He will give us the news. All is well in the world, despite what we're talking about over the next 2 hours. You at least know the baseline is that Ray is back in the chair giving us the news. You will hear him in mere moments right after this.
But
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let me just remind you of who's on our program for this episode. If you are just joining us, Robert Brigham is here, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, and Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. And we thank all of you for being with us, and we thank our audience for joining us as well. We give you the opportunity to get in on the conversation, panel at WAMC.org. A special legislative session in Texas is set to begin today in the wake of the flood in Texas Hill Country, and it's shaping up to be an emotionally raw diversion into what Democrats say is the gerrymandering the state's House district. Lawmakers will also take up questions about the handling of the devastating July 4th flood, which killed more than 130 people, including at least 37 children. But that bipartisan imperative will be complicated by a hard-edged partisan agenda for the session, dominated by President Trump's push for the legislature to redraw the state's congressional district maps to be more favorable for Republicans. He wants his party to gain 5 seats in Texas in the 2026 midterm elections to help retain control of the U.S. House. Governor Greg Abbott has asked lawmakers to also consider a dozen other items during the 30-day special session, including new hardline conservative proposals to ban mail-order abortion pills, lower property taxes, and regulate intoxicating hemp. However, we are going to focus on the redistricting part of this and this Trump imperative to redraw the state's congressional district maps to be more favorable for Republicans. Libby, this is your life. Not in Texas, but this is your life.
How disgusting.
Oh, let me just turn that
over. Okay.
Go ahead.
How disgusting is it that this man, well, both of them, but this man,
meaning Abbott and Trump.
Yeah, Madam and Trump. But Trump is only looking at the politics after this horrific loss of life. Do we expect it to be any different? No. But this is who we have as President of the United States. It's all transactional for this man, and these kids couldn't vote for him, so he really didn't care, right? It's all transactional. This notion of rewriting the rules, rewriting the lines, just so that he can maintain the majority in the House, you know, A, probably won't happen. Even if they pass it, it's going to go to the courts. It's going to take a while, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, things have to be set in motion by December for the next year's elections, all of that sort of stuff. But the idea that Greg Abbott, who is a toady of Trump, there's no two ways about it, would capitulate so quickly, you know, is absurd. The anti-abortion pills is absurd. All of it is just absurd. This state is in mourning for the loss of young life, and they're looking at this as how we can gain some political points out of it. It's disgusting.
Yeah, I agree with Libby on all fronts, of course. It's unlikely they'll get this done before the December 8th deadline. It definitely will be challenged in courts. And it, one of the reasons it'll be challenged in courts, this mid-decade redistricting is not something that happens usually. You usually have to wait to the end of the decade in the census and you follow up with that. It occasionally, historically, this happens, but it's really, this is an off one. The one thing that does give me concern about this, though, is how much easier it is going to be to do this kind of backroom politics since the dismantling of many of the key aspects of the 1964 Voters' Rights Act. This makes me nervous that this is a, even if this effort is not successful in Texas, because it is so crass and so transactional, I am worried that what's happened to the Voting Rights Act of 1964 in the last 2 years will pave the way for more attempts to just do a naked power grab like this.
Yeah, there's nothing new under the Texas political sun, at least. And so this is a kind of a redo of what we saw in the early 2000s. It's hard to believe, given the situation now in Texas, that there was a time when Democrats were in the majority there. They had a Democratic governor, and also they had a majority in their House delegation up until 2004. And you might remember Tom DeLay.
Oh, right.
And so he was involved in an earlier version of this. The Democrats held the House, the House delegation majority 17-15, and they decided to do redistricting. It did go to the courts. The person who argued the case on behalf of Texas was the Solicitor General at the time, Ted Cruz. And they were able to proceed. After the redistricting, the numbers flipped, and then it was a GOP majority 21-11. The current numbers, because there are now more congressional seats in Texas, is 25-12. So it's not even close. Donald Trump is trying to squeeze five more votes out of this. Now the math gets interesting. I mean, I think it is worth us just thinking about gerrymandering. You know, both parties do it. People tend to blame the other party and say they don't. But, you know, there's a long tradition of both parties doing it, including in this state. And this state actually is one that did changing the lines at a different time other than the census. We did it recently because the legislature had so heavily gerrymandered the districts, they were thrown out by the courts, and then they had to redraw them. And when this happened, there was a special master, and then Kathy Hochul was blamed for losing a lot of seats, and then they were redrawn again. And I mean, so New York is not immune to this either. Mm-hmm. And there's been other states more recently, usually in the wake of legal cases or some other legal constraint that they have to do it. But, you know, I think, when I think about gerrymandering, I think, well, why does it work? And the reason it works, and it works so well now, is one, we have the technological tools to really kind of go house by house by house and draw those lines accordingly. Secondly, it's almost too easy to predict how people are going to vote. And that is because there are really no swing voters left. People vote so predictably because you can see if they have voted and what their party registration is, and you can be almost sure of how they're going to vote. And so you can draw these lines in a way. Now, the thing is, when you start drawing the new lines in Texas, you're going to have to take some away from the current GOP members. I mean, that math is not going to be easy to do. But there we are.
And we should also note that Governor Newsom in California is threatening to
do the same thing
in California to gain five seats. So this could be an interesting ride.
Which one listener refers to as bringing a gun to a gunfight?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
not a knife. You know, I get what you're saying about knowing how people are going to vote, but there is still a swing with the number of people who are not registered to a party.
Yeah.
And we don't know how they vote. And that number is growing and growing and growing because people are disaffected by both parties. And so, you know, when you look at the voter registration numbers, not here in the city of Albany, but in other places, I'm working at the 5th Judicial District. The NOPs is what we're calling them, and that's what they're identified as, no party people. It's a large swath of that electorate.
Second biggest electorate in New York City.
Right.
Yeah.
And you just don't know.
They did swing in New York City.
Yes.
Trump was able to pull a sizable number of them over. So as we've seen more and more data that's been properly analyzed after the 2024 elections, not the exit data, which is always off base, but we've seen more that you can really dig into it. Those voters are key. They're very hard to figure into gerrymandering because they're wild cards. But they also tend to turn out for presidential elections and stay home for everything else.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that. I mean, one of the reasons ostensibly why New York State is moving to all even year elections, right, is so that more people come out to vote for local offices.
Right.
Because you see it over and over and over again that Republicans do come out in the local races and the Democrats come out in the even year races, Assembly, Senate, Governor, Attorney General, President, U.S. Senate, Congress.
In 2024, there was, and maybe it's not surprising, but there was an astounding number of people who came out and voted, cast a vote for president, and didn't do anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's really also noteworthy and makes the people who were digging in on the numbers and trying to gerrymander, it makes it very tough for them.
Yeah, because
so there could be some really curious and surprising results in Texas if they try to redo these lines.
Because there's no coattails is what you're saying.
Right.
And down ballot races aren't benefiting from a strong leader. And the other part of what's going on in Texas is that they're going to have to undo majority-minority districts.
Yes.
And, you know, the Voting Rights Act sort of said, that's okay, or the destruction of it. But I think you'll see a lot of lawsuits.
Yeah. The other thing is, politics, as you all know, is an interesting business. It's sort of like being a general. You're always fighting the last war. I think it's going to be harder to predict how some of these folks are going to vote than they did vote in the last election. And you might bite off more than you can chew on forecasting where neighborhoods are going to vote.
Especially with the impact of the big BS bill, right? People are going to feel that impact. I mean, Medicaid cuts won't kick in until 2027, but SNAP, all the rest of it, it's now. It's happening now. So, and it's those folks, right, who some of them come out to vote, but they will now be given a reason to vote, and the grassroots organizing that will hopefully happen will get them out to vote. So there's no guarantee that the GOP is going to be able to benefit from all of this because of what they've done to their own people. The majority of people who are being hurt by this bill are in the red states.
So are we going to see, I think you brought this up initially, the timing isn't going to work here, so it's going to be difficult to get done, but I was struck by what you said, but it does open the floodgates for the future elections, and you know those machinations are
are already underway.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the peculiarities of Texas politics that says December 8th because they have this kind of weird, almost semi-voluntary special session. But what if you're not in special session? What if mm-hmm. you're just going to do this in regular session? Mm-hmm. You don't have those kind of deadlines. You kick right. kick the can down the road and dismantle election protections and do more damage, if possible, to the 64 Voting Rights Act. Yeah, this worries me.
What and the other point I just wanted to make before we move on to another topic, but and this is and you touched on this, Libby, but this is in addition to all of the other things that are being done to impact the voting in this country, right?
Yes.
The fairness of or what many people would perceive as the fairness of voting.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just piling on, and if you can if mid-decade redistricting becomes a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
We're in trouble.
We're in big trouble.
Right.
You know, I've worked on elections in other countries, worked on democratic institutions in other countries, and if we just saw the profile of what's happening in Texas and what's happening with voting rights across the country, this would be all kinds of red flags for any other country.
Right.
We'd say, okay, this is a place that is in potential crisis, serious backsliding is happening in this place. And so I don't know that Americans really have their head around how serious these sorts of things are. I know that I encounter people all the time who are saying, like, well, you know, things are bad now, but it's we'll be able to right the ship with the midterm elections. And number one, we have a long way to go until that. And number two, all of these things that are being done, some of them that we're talking about today that are obvious, like in Texas, others that are being done administratively, locality by locality mm-hmm. in different states, these all chip away at the legitimacy of our elections and have potential real effects on the outcomes of those elections.
Let's move on. We just have a few moments before our bottom of the hour break. Actually, one or two letters. Steve says, Gavin Newsom is proposing, that's what we mentioned, redistricting California to get more Dems into the U.S. House. He's bringing a gun to a gunfight. That was the letter I mentioned earlier. And was there was another one here buried in the muck. Since both parties gerrymander, voters should end party registration and just stay registered to vote. What would this do?
Say that again.
Since both parties gerrymander voters, voters should end party registration and just stay registered to vote.
Just be an NOP.
Yes.
It would make it impossible to predict any kind of election if that would happen. But it would also mean that campaigns would have to be much more focused on that part of the electorate with a message that will move them. And if we don't know what party they're in, it's really hard to figure out what message will move them. I know there are things like scores and things like that and data that we have access to that is helpful, right? Who's pro-choice, who's, you know, not, who's this, who's that. But still, it'll be difficult, make things more difficult. But there'll be some brilliant computer guy, tech guy, or a girl who comes up with something to help people like me make some informed decisions based on that.
But as it is now, the parties are so strong as electoral mechanisms, and you know, people will always say, well, we ought to have multiple parties, but in the kind of system we have, that just doesn't work. And you know, we've actually seen a sorting out over the last 20 or 30 years, so the parties are more right wing on one side and more left wing
yes.
on the other side. And so I think it's I hear what the letter writer is saying, but I think it's going in a different direction than that.
It wasn't that long ago that party affiliation wasn't really as important as your politics. You know, moderate Republicans
mm-hmm.
and
yep.
liberal Democrats worked together to get the 57 Civil Rights Act passed and the 64 you know, voters and right. It used to be the ideas that animated the voters.
I remember when we had pro-choice Republicans in this in the state assembly, in the state senate. You know, and they stood up for what was right, but not anymore.
Yeah, and we had, you know, fairly conservative Democrats, strong pro-defense, anti-Soviet Democrats, Scoop Jackson,
Hawks,
and others.
Right.
Those times seem like ancient times now.
E writes to us and says, if they are redrawing the map for voters, what's to stop them from going after the voters themselves? Since it seems like they can do whatever they want, what protects people from being targeted for how they voted?
I think they've already gone after voters. Not that they're going to. I think they already have by dismantling the 1964 Civil Rights Act to the level they have.
And I mean, I was reading into that a sense of like personal, like, you know, violence against, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it seemed that of going after a voter for their action within the booth.
Well, I think it's a little more difficult to do that these days with the electronic things, because back in the day when you had the lever machines, you could set them to make certain kinds of noises to know if somebody voted Republican or Democrat. But with the with the machines
now,
I
want to hear this.
With electronic voting, I mean, you know, is it easy to find out how somebody voted electronically right then and there? I don't think so. But is it easy to screw around with the electronic voting? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so this circles back to our previous conversation about conspiracy theories.
Right.
So Mike Lindell, the pillow guy. You know, he has spent gazillions of his own dollars to try to put forward the, you know, the election fraud case. And there's been, you know, serious cases against certain companies that run electronic voting systems. One of those system companies, they pushed back and they sued the people that were saying these things about them. And I think they've won across the board. But, yeah, the vulnerability of these systems, whether real or perceived, leads to a variety of new challenges. I mean, just my own experience working in Ukraine on the elections in 2014, the Russians hacked the system and brought the whole system down, and they had to revert to doing it paper ballots. And in many people were saying then that they had more confidence in the paper ballots anyway, so it's good that the Russians did that. But, you know, it took like 4 days to count the votes instead of being able to do it immediately. So it's, it opens up a whole new set of challenges. I mean, opportunities and things that are good, but whether it's targeting specific voters, hacking into systems, bringing systems down, it's a wild, wild west of voting now.
Right. A wild west that you can't trust who's going to be in charge of overseeing it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue and have our last segment together. And not like forever, but just today.
Just for today.
Just for today. Then we'll be back. And we welcome you to join us. We would love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Have a couple of other interesting stories to discuss, and we will get to those after our break. Some announcements and then news from the BBC. We would love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue all of this after this short break. And there are no exceptions to the rule. Yes, everybody's somebody's fool. I told myself it's a good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Robert Brigham, Jim Ketter, and Libby Post making up our panel this morning. And we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We just have about 15 minutes together, and we will make the most of it as we go forward on a couple more news stories that I'd like to get to on this Monday morning. Let's begin with the Pentagon, and as the Washington Post puts it, the churn continues. That is that apparently is not good. another senior aide to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is leaving the Pentagon, officials said over the weekend, marking at least the sixth departure of a top advisor in Hegseth's first 6 months in office. Justin Folker, who was named a senior advisor to the defense secretary in late April, said in a text message to the Washington Post that his departure is perfectly amicable and that he planned all along to complete just 6 months of government service. He said he is grateful to Hegseth, to President Trump, and to the extraordinary civilians and service members who turn vision into action every single day. Sean Parnell, a Pentagon spokesman, acknowledged Folker's departure in a text message after CBS first reported that he had been fired. Parnell said it was not fair to characterize the exit as a firing and called Folker a great guy. The Pentagon also issued a short statement from Parnell that said the Defense Department is grateful for the work Folker did on behalf of President Trump and Secretary Hegseth. We wish him well in his future endeavors. Don't let the door
hit you. Right,
Hegseth, a former Fox News personality, came to the cabinet job with little prior managerial experience and a struggle to achieve cohesion among his inner circle of aides. This staff churn, along with Hegseth's other early missteps, has drawn sharp scrutiny from Congress and at times even the White House. The latest shakeup follows a report by the Post published last week that detailed an unusual situation ahead of his appointment in April, in which Folker, then a member of billionaire Elon Musk's U.S. Doge service, stormed out of a meeting with the Pentagon Doge team lead and sought help from Hegseth's front office. As the Post reported, Folker told Hegseth and other senior officials in the secretary's office that he thought the Pentagon Force Protection Agency, an internal police and security organization, was looking for him. That upset Hegseth, who then summoned Weiss to his office and confronted him, raising his voice at times, people familiar with the altercation said. Weiss, a tech entrepreneur who had just taken over as the Pentagon's Doge team lead, denied having called law enforcement, telling Hegseth that instead he had reported Folker to a government official with the Defense Department Transition Office that assists newly arriving political appointees. That, according to a person familiar with that encounter, a lot of encounters, a lot of people, and a lot going on. And I guess the word that we've been using, churn, seems to be an apt one. Jim?
Well, as you were detailing all that, Joe, I was just thinking, and this also goes for Pam Bondi and Kash Patel at the Department of Justice and the FBI. You know, we live in a dangerous world, and to get through the day and to go about our business, we don't dwell on it that much. It would be impossible to just live your life. But the reality is that it is an extremely dangerous world, and when you're in those positions, it's 24/7 threats. The stakes are high. The margin for error is very, very slim. And our adversaries are watching this kind of nonsense, mm-hmm. being distracted by Epstein, being distracted by staff churn and this sort of thing. And, you know, I don't know. Who would have guessed that a Fox News host wouldn't have been adept at managing one of the most complex organizations on the face of the planet?
Yeah. In the 50s and early 1960s, there was a very clear demographic for the Secretary of Defense. It was the leaders of your largest corporations, because it's a corporation. It is the single biggest office building in the United States. Has 26,000 daily employees. You know, Charlie Wilson, head of GM, Robert McNamara, head of Ford. There's a reason why you have to have those kind of complex abilities. And this is a huge enterprise. And he just isn't up for the job.
You know, I was struck by this story too, because Folker was one of the guys. This was a last month. The Guardian reported that he had told Hegseth's personal attorney, as well as the chief of staff for Hegseth, that he knew of surveillance measures that could be used to find leakers in the Pentagon. So he joined this effort to find the leakers, but officials at the White House and in the Pentagon later determined that Folker had exaggerated his usefulness, and the purported evidence he had alluded to did not exist. I just, and maybe this is being a little too cynical, but you know, if the Trump administration and Hegseth believe that you're a loose cannon, that can't be, right? That's not the best.
No. But I also think this whole thing of, oh, I was only going to complete just 6 months of government service. Give me a break, right. Will you? Yeah. Nobody, I mean, come on.
Most people want employment for as long as they can.
Yeah,
keep
I mean,
it.
But yeah. Also, who goes into government thinking, oh, I'm only going to be here for 6 months, especially somebody of his level, okay? He's not like, well, oh, he's been in and out of government forever, and he knows how the, you know, everything's made and all that sort of stuff. He knows how the sausage is made, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't. And to say, oh, I was only going to be here for 6 months, I found that to be totally disingenuous.
But sometimes, Libby, you know, even 6 months ahead, that you want to spend more time with your family.
Yes, it's true. But does he have one?
Even
does
if your family doesn't agree.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Let's find out if he has a family. One moment, please.
You know, you just put that into the into the contract, and then it comes back to you later. So what is too much for this? I mean, as you say, this churn, like, at what point
I think his days are numbered. It really is.
Who, Hegseth?
Hegseth. Yeah. Not just from a managerial standpoint. I mean, they got out of the Iran attack, luckily, because there were all sorts of opportunities for that to go south. Trump forecasted it at number one, so they had to have a decoy. I think it's going to be something not managerial, but operational. And that's, you know, when that shoe drop is any minute. I can't see him lasting.
I mean, we thought this even after the Signal controversy that wasn't going to last after that, especially in the second round. And yet he has. All right. We have about 10 minutes. Harvard and the Trump administration face off in court over funding cuts. Harvard claims the administration's move to slash billions in federal funding is unlawful. Both sides are asking a judge to rule in their favor without a trial. This is the nation's oldest university facing off in court against the president of the United States today in a legal showdown, the outcome of which will reverberate across American higher education. Does anybody think they have a read on what can happen? Or what will happen, more appropriately?
You guys are academics.
Well, none of it's good. Anytime I think that you get the executive this involved in what's going on a campus, the endowment tax issue is serious. The wanting to approve curriculum. I don't know if you guys are familiar with what happened in the state of Ohio. But I think that's what Trump would like to happen with Harvard. And it will destroy academic freedom in this country if this moves forward.
Well, that's what they want.
Yeah.
You know, they're fascists. They're authoritarians. They want people, they want the youth, to learn exactly what they want them to learn. And it's like Hitler Youth. It's the same sort of thing. And, you know, they also want to get rid of tenure. They want to get rid of the unions. They want to get rid of all of it. Just remember, Trump said in 2016, he was hugging a flag and said, I love the uneducated. And that's his base.
You know, one of the key sectors that allowed us to prevail in the Cold War was our universities and colleges. And the rise of the great American research university, it obviously, we already had great institutions, but particularly with the start of the Cold War and across administrations from both parties and with support from both sides of the aisle in Congress, these institutions have become these kind of magnetizing forces that have brought such great talent, has trained great talent from within our own country and attracted great talent from across the world. And so, as Bob and Libby were saying, going after the research money, the endowments, and international students, if you do those three things, which they are actively seeking to do, you kill the goose that has laid the golden egg. And I don't know how we piece that back together. I used to oversee a program, a State Department program, when I was in Egypt called Education USA. And it was the whole purpose of it is to attract students to come to the United States. And even in those days, this was a few years ago, students and their families who would disagree with American foreign policy would still want to come here. It was still the place to go. And so I'm already hearing all kinds of stories of students who have been accepted, students who have gotten some scholarship money, although most international students are full payers, and they're saying, not coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be part of whatever is going on there. This is just absolutely deadly for the United States.
All the intractable problems that we face, the university, the college, liberal arts college, those are the homes of the solutions. Innovation happens in Silicon Valley, but its real DNA is at the university. The unforeseen things that don't happen, things that we don't know aren't going to happen in a research lab, things that we don't know that aren't going to be painted or drawn or spoken or sung, we're just going to lose as a society.
Meanwhile, the Chinese are mm-hmm. working hard to ramp up their institutions and other countries with great universities are working hard to attract our scientists and our incoming students.
There's already been a little bit of a brain drain out of Yale to Toronto. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, three key faculty members.
Well, we're no longer going to be the country of the best and the brightest. And that's what they want.
And let's just end because, again, we talked about a little bit on Friday just because it played into what we were talking about of the loss of funding for National Public Radio and public broadcasting. But that is the decision by Paramount to cancel the Late Show with Stephen Colbert. This is the number one show in late night. Stephen Colbert is one of the their prime people to put out in front, and was someone who was because he had the highest rated late night talk show, was also someone that not just in the ratings but also in the information and the bits that were shared online was at the top of his game. So at that point, in the midst of the 60 Minutes decision and also by concerns over a merger that suddenly out of nowhere, even though some had worried that this could be a possibility, that they were going to cancel the show and then it was going to end. And it was going to end at the end of Stephen Colbert's contract, which is May of 2026.
You know, CBS, well, first of all, William Paley and Edward R. Murrow are turning in their graves. That's number one. CBS has a history of this. They went after the Smothers Brothers, remember mm-hmm. them? And Johnson, because they went after him. They went after President Johnson. And Johnson said, it is part of the price of leadership of this great and free nation to be the target of clever satirists. We have given the gift of laughter to our people, May we never grow so somber or self-important that we fail to appreciate the humor in our lives. And, you know, this is just one more way of silencing dissent. And the other part of all of this, I mean, I know that there's going to be a merger and all of that, but Trump and his crew know that today's journalism isn't what it used to be 25, 30 years ago. They know the daily papers are weakened, that they are being bought up by hedge funds like Lee and other places, right, other companies. They know that that newsrooms that used to be populated are no longer, and they are using that as well as all of these corporate interests to silence the media.
I think Libby's hit on a really important point here, and that is if you add this mess with the Kennedy Center,
right?
The arts are under attack by this administration. There is no humor, there is no art, there is no poetry in this White House. There's not even a pet.
Well, he thinks it's low class to have a pet, you know.
Yeah, that's all you really need to know. We're out of time, Jim. I apologize.
All right, that's okay.
You can hold it in until your next visit, and then you can just let loose. I've seen you do that. It's really good.
Yeah,
so,
it's ugly.
Well, my thanks to everybody. We'll be back right after this.